From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Happy Thanksgiving weekend. Are you too full already? I understand. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, and we're very thankful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. And keep us in mind on December 2nd, this year's Giving Tuesday. On our interfaith calendar, November 30th is the Catholic and Orthodox St. Andrew's Day, and it is also the beginning of the Christian season of Advent. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
Pastor under fire for his role in his son's same-sex wedding ceremony. The Reverend broke Methodist church law officiating the wedding and now faces a church trial that could lead to him being defrocked.
I had never done a gay wedding before. I had never even been to a gay wedding before.
Last month, Schaefer was reinstated by the Judicial Council.
Marriage equality has made tremendous progress as a civil right recently. At the same time, the issue has been hotly debated within faith communities as well. Earlier this year, the Reverend Frank Schaefer faced the loss of his ministry in the United Methodist Church for performing the same-gender wedding of his son. It's been a 7-year ordeal involving church trials, a defrocking last year, appeals, and finally reinstatement just last month. This summer, Reverend Schaefer published a book about his journey titled Defrocked, How a Father's Act of Love Shook the United Methodist Church. And he'll be with us later on the show this week.
There is a connection between the growing hostility toward biblical Christianity here at home and persecution abroad.
I think Christianity is under attack ultimately from Satan himself, who's been trying to extinguish the Christian message ever since he inspired Herod to try to kill the Christ child.
We are under attack. And I do believe that if we remain silent and if we stay silent, I believe that we could one day see that persecution crop up here in this country.
It's becoming more and more apparent that the central front in the culture wars is an ever broader definition of religious liberty. And defining anything from basic health care to civil rights rules for businesses in terms of an affront to that liberty. As we celebrate Thanksgiving, there's the overarching theme of religious liberty that the pilgrims came here searching for. But is there any resemblance between that pursuit and today's public rhetoric? I'll ask Dr. Peter Gardella, author of the book American Civil Religion, What Americans Hold Sacred. But first...
So with lots of hard work and working together with their new friends, the Indians, by the end of the season... they had an abundant harvest.
God, we thank you for our families and friends, and for thy many blessings.
Amen to that.
Hi, we should do this every year.
Inherent in the iconic imagery of our traditional Thanksgiving is a meal shared by settlers and those who were here way before the settlers. Joining me now is Dennis Zotai, an American Indian who works with the National Museum of the American Indian. Dennis, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I understand there are many American Indian nations and that there's great diversity in the spiritual life of the peoples that comprise them. My own experience is that it's a deep, deep spirituality from which we can learn a lot. But there are some overarching themes, and I'd like for you to introduce us, if you would, to some of those themes.
We are very diverse, and you really hit a very important point. Our cultures in the United States are as diverse as Japanese is from German, mm-hmm. and as German is from Brazilian. They're mm-hmm. that different.
Hmm.
Our languages, our lifeways, our food, clothing, dwellings, protocols, and spirituality are very autonomous from one another.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the characteristic themes of American Indian spirituality?
A belief in one creator. That's one thing we share all in common.
What do we need to know about the situation for American Indians in the northeastern part of the colonies at the time in history that the whole Thanksgiving story was born?
That Indians actually gave thanks at these types of feasts always. It wasn't just this one time. This is more of the European colonialist Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh.
But Indians have always given thanks.
Is there any chance that the whole idea of Thanksgiving in that setting came from the Indians rather than from the Pilgrims?
Actually, the Indians brought more than their share of the food, but it wasn't the food that we are popularly eating in the year 2014. There was lobster, there was clams, there were eels, there was venison, there was waterfowl, there was maple syrup and popcorn.
Is that right? Would this have been an unusual thing to happen for the Puritans and Indians to sit down together for this kind of meal?
I wouldn't think so. I mean, they were, to a degree, both very religious and would appreciate sharing a meal with the people they shared the land with mm-hmm. at the time.
Mm-hmm. Were there ways that American Indian spirituality led them to be more vulnerable to the newcomers than they otherwise might have been?
Yes, because we didn't have a written language, and a person's word was taken as kind of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people made agreements, the colonial atmosphere, they had motives to it. But when more people from Europe came over, it changed the intent
mm-hmm.
of dealing with Native people.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, when the first treaties were made, we were called brothers, and it always said brothers, mm-hmm. brethren. But then later treaties, towards the end of the treaty-making process, it was children.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see the ideology of how we were perceived as time went on and as more Europeans came to the Americas.
Hmm. Dennis, talk, if you will, about the role that spirituality plays in the life today of American Indians.
Again, there are so many Native people. I can't speak for all of them
uh-huh.
Because I would say only a quarter of Native people still live in their communities and reservations,
mm-hmm.
and the majority have moved away and lived in other areas, particularly in urban areas, and they have, for generations, assimilated into mm-hmm. whatever areas they're in. Today, I know of Mormon Native Americans. I know of Jewish Native Americans. I even know a Taoist Native American. So the old perception that we only abide by our ceremonies and we live like our ancestors is not true mm-hmm. anymore. But yes, in our communities, we do still have our spiritual ceremonies. But there's just not as many Natives living there
sure.
to partake of them. And learn them.
I think what you've said is of tremendous importance that we understand the diversity of the American Indian
community. Exactly.
Yeah. Is there any pattern to whether or not American Indians today will sit down for a Thanksgiving meal on Thanksgiving Day, or are there negative feelings about that?
You know, I put this on the internet, and these are some of the comments I got about celebrating Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
I was infuriated when my daughter's school had a mock feast complete with paper mache headdresses and pilgrim's hat.
Yeah.
Second comment, what they did to my two kids in elementary, I tore those items up and signed my kids out of school for that day.
Mm-hmm.
Third comment, someone took a picture of me in front of the class, and to this day it bothers me. Don't get the whole making a fest in school.
Hmm.
Another one, tonight I have to lead a children's Bible class, and they want me to theme it around Thanksgiving. I will, but it's not going to be about the happy pilgrims and all that stuff. Thankfulness to God is one thing, but elevating pilgrims to a hero status is out of the question.
Hmm. So, Dennis, it brings me to this question. If people are really serious about taking American Indians seriously and being grateful for their presence in this nation and caring about their welfare, what issues would they be thinking about most this year at Thanksgiving or at any time during the year regarding the welfare of the American Indian communities?
Keeping our lands sacred. The Keystone XL pipeline bill just failed. And Native people see it as a great victory because the pipeline is going to be going through Indian lands, whether they like it or not, this bill passes. And number two, fracking. It's hurting our Mother Earth already. Mm-hmm. This drilling process leaves great holes, and there's been earthquakes where there haven't been earthquakes before.
Mm-hmm.
All these are disrupting what we consider, you know, Mother Earth.
Yeah. You live in Washington, D.C., and I live in Washington, D.C., and we hear at least every other day or so about the Washington Redskins and whether or not the title of that team ought to be changed. How should we view that? I'm not asking if you want to share your opinion on it, fine,
well,
but I'm asking how should we view it?
It's more about dignity and respect. I mean, it's a racial slur. Does the American public want to condone racial slurs and wear it on a jersey in public and say it's okay? The main issue is there's a greedy man out there, and he's very wealthy, and money can buy anything. Money can buy votes. Money can buy human beings. And that's what's taking place. And arrogancy, and it's just the way America is.
Yeah.
I mean.
Dennis, tell me the tribes with which you are associated.
My father is a Kiowa Indian, and my mother is Owenge Pueblo, which is one of the 19 federally recognized Pueblos in New Mexico. And also Santee Dakota from the state of Nebraska. And that means I'm three tribes, Kiowa, Okawinge Pueblo, and Santee Dakota.
Dennis Zotai works as a cultural specialist with the National Museum of the American Indian. And Dennis, I want to thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio today and giving us valuable information and also some inspiration about the ways in which we think together about the presence of the American Indian community.
Certainly.
Religious liberty. It was an abiding theme of what the pilgrims came to the new country searching for, and today it's the centerpiece of the American culture wars. So, does the concept, as it was understood then, share anything with the concept as we know it now? Dr. Peter Gardella is the author of the book, American Civil Religion, What Americans Hold Sacred, and Dr. Gardella joins us right now on State of Belief Radio. Peter, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Welton.
You focus your book on what Americans have held sacred throughout history, both religious concepts and purely secular concepts. What role did religion play in the self-concept of the earliest settlers, and what secular components of their adventure was or has become culturally religious?
Ooh, big question. Religion, of course, was pretty central, certainly to the pilgrims who came to Plymouth. They were going, as you say, in search of religious liberty. Now, down in Jamestown, they're reputed to have been a little more secular. But even at Plymouth, you know, they didn't really separate these things. There weren't any clergy, you know, prominent on the Mayflower. It really was Elder Brewster and you know, the lay people who led. And there was an Anglican priest with the first settlers at Jamestown who brought a big cross on and set up his religion. So I don't think this differentiation really mattered to them. It doesn't matter very much to me either, honestly, because I define religion as the system of non-rational commitments that holds life together. Lego, it comes from. I bind. It has to do with what's obligatory. And a lot of people might say the money-making is a secular thing that has become sacred, but again, I would disagree with that, because although they certainly wanted to prosper at Jamestown and at Plymouth, they had some skepticism about greed. They had some skepticism, and they held all property in common for a while at Jamestown. And they certainly had a lot of skepticism about individuals seeking great riches for themselves in both places. John Winthrop, the first governor of Massachusetts Bay, criticize that idea of seeking great fortunes to the exclusion of other things.
Well, Dr. Gardella, have we sacralized these first settlers?
I think so, yes. It's hard to think of them without a little glow of reverence. I think they deserve it, though. I mean, a person like Pocahontas or John Smith, Brewster at Plymouth, or Governor Bradford at Plymouth. I mean, these were heroes. They lived lives that were like something out of Star Trek, honestly. If you think about going across the Atlantic and adapting, you know, to this new circumstances. And so, although, yes, I'd say we have sacralized them, on the other hand, I think they deserve being revered.
So if we had been there at Plymouth when the boat docked and talked to the first people getting off the boat, and the question was, why are you here? Would they have said, because we're searching for religious freedom?
Not all of them. Some of them were servants. Some of them were people who were just coming along hoping for a better life, maybe an opportunity to get some land that they did not have in England. The leaders, certainly, Brewster and Governor Bradford would have said something along those lines. Miles Standish, the soldier, he might not have. You know, he was a, like John Smith, you had to have a military expert with you. They were explorers, you know, and not all of them were necessarily had Christianity uppermost in their mind.
Do you see any connection between those early ideas and what we have come today to call religious liberty and oppression? Because it seems confused today. Was it confused then?
They wanted liberty. They wanted freedom. I don't think that they were confused about that. And freedom itself has become a religious dimension of life for Americans. I mean, when I talk about American civil religion, people often will say, and a lot of the evangelicals, in fact, these days despise American civil religion. They will say, oh, this is the worship of America. We want Jesus. You know, we don't want American civil religion. But the point about American civil religion is that it is not the worship of America. American civil religion enshrines the value, above all, of personal freedom and of political democracy and cultural tolerance and peace. Those values, I think, are really what people are worshiping when they are practicing American civil religion. And God is not necessarily part of that. Can be, sometimes isn't.
And sometimes God seems to be wearing the cloak of an American.
Well, less and less. I would argue less and less, because, you know, if you look at what's happened at a place like Plymouth, that was much more true in the 1920s than it is today.
I
mean, since 1970, they've been having a National Day of Mourning at Plymouth, and the descendants of the Wampanoag Indians who were there greeting the Puritans when they came on shore, They buried Plymouth Rock in 1970. They threw the model of the ship's captain of the Mayflower overboard. But they have since been integrated, at least uneasily, but there's a plaque for the National Day of Mourning there. Their ceremonies go on every year peaceably.
Mm-hmm.
At Jamestown, it's gone from a place that was celebrating just the English, and Queen Elizabeth came in 1957 and celebrated just the English, to a place that explicitly celebrates the meeting of three great peoples, the Indians, the English, and the Africans who came to Jamestown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the National Park Service thing is about. And in Washington today, you have places like the United States Holocaust Memorial and Museum, the National Museum of the American Indian. So even Washington, even the District of Columbia itself, is not wearing the cloak of an American as much as it once did.
Exactly. Dr. Gardella, if we view that historical arc through the lens of secular religion, as you describe it in your book, can that help us understand the power of the idea of religious oppression in this country when, in fact, true examples of that abound in other parts of the world beyond any that we could imagine happening here?
I think that, we're profoundly, even providentially, dare I say it, blessed in that regard. And even with the war on terror and all of the struggles that have happened since 9/11, the opportunities that has created for religious oppression here, there's been surprisingly little of it. And the United States is still the great force against religious oppression
mm-hmm.
worldwide.
Yeah. I am of the opinion that where we are in religious freedom today and in support for it is a very confusing place for many reasons. And I have the sense that religious freedom, as defined in the Constitution, has never been really secure in this nation. It's always been in trouble from one point of view or another. Do you think that has any credibility?
Oh, yes. I'm fond of saying you can separate church and state, but you can't separate religion and politics.
Uh-huh.
The thing is that they both deal with life and death issues. So if you're going to go to war, religion is going to be involved, inevitably. You can't send people to kill and to die without invoking something of the basic commitments that hold life together.
Uh-huh.
They're not going to die for oil, at least not consciously. It's going to have to be about something deeper than that. So whenever you're doing anything significant in the government, it's going to involve religion. People mm-hmm. can't take their religion out of their heads and their hearts when they go to cast their ballots. No nation is without some civil religion. In some ways, the United States has to have one more urgently because we don't have any common native culture. We're using a borrowed language, borrowed land. We don't have a deep ethnic history. People become Americans by pledging allegiance. They become Americans by undertaking these commitments. It's a nation with the soul of a church, Chesterton
mm-hmm.
said. It's a nation with the soul of a voluntary church.
Yeah, yeah. For those of us who want to use some period of this Thanksgiving celebration to really think about our nation and where we need to be, based on those twin concepts of religion and liberty, give us a subject for academic meditation.
We live in an age of religious warfare. Since 1947, 1948, probably the greatest age of religious warfare since the Reformation. And we thought we were beyond religious warfare, but we're not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that on this Thanksgiving, we should give thanks that our nation has been spared the worst of it so far and ask whatever power we implore for the wisdom to steer through the rest of this to a peaceful destination. Peace was very prominent in the early settlers' desires. They were tired of war. They'd come from a Europe that had been racked by religious war for more than a century, and they were seeking peace. And I think they found it by and large, in the end, although obviously with some problems. But we need, I think, to reflect on that and ask for this wisdom to get through this particular moment of threat to religious liberty and of religious warfare.
Dr. Peter Gardella is a member of the Department of World Religions at Manhattanville College in Purchase, New York. He's the author of the book, American Civil Religion, What Americans Hold Sacred. Dr. Gardella, it's been a pleasure talking with you and exploring this complex aspect of the American character. I really do thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio, and I hope you have a good Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It was 7 years ago that the Reverend Frank Schaeffer, a United Methodist Church minister in Pennsylvania, officiated at the wedding of his son, Tim. Not unusual, except that Tim was marrying another man. The intervening years have been both a source of spiritual growth and of headline-making conflicts with Reverend Schaeffer's church. It's a story he tells in his book, Defrocked, How a Father's Act of Love Shook the United Methodist Church. A church appeals court made a final ruling last month, reinstating Reverend Schaeffer in the tradition he's devoted his life to, and it gives me great pleasure to be able to welcome Frank Schaeffer to State of Belief Radio. Frank, welcome.
Thank you so much, Walt.
If you would, I'd like you to expand just a little bit on my summary of how all of this got started 7 years ago.
Just in a nutshell, my son, Tim, came out to my wife and I in 2000, and it turned out that he had a real struggle with his sexual orientation and with the messages that he had heard from the church, which had been really harmful to him. He believed that he was going to hell as a homosexual, and he tried to pray it away. When that didn't work, he tried suicide. And when this all came out, my wife and I, of course, rallied around him and put our arms around him and told him, "We love you so much, son. We will always love you." And we supported him. And we said, obviously, you know, this is not a choice. You tried to pray this away. You didn't want to be homosexual. You didn't choose this. And so we had given him all these affirmations. So when in 2006 my son called and told us about the engagement to Bobby and asked me if I would perform his wedding, you know, there was no way I could have said no to my son. Mm-hmm. Because that would have negated all of those affirmations. And I didn't want to. It was a joyful thing for me. And so then in 2007, I performed this marriage, and it was a beautiful affair. It took almost 6 years before a parishioner of mine in the Iona Church in Lebanon County, Pennsylvania, filed a complaint against me. And so all of this came out in 2013, and it began this long process of a trial within the United Methodist Church. I was found guilty, even though I tried to plead my case to say this was an act of love, this was not an act of rebellion. You know, I did this in the secrecy of our family. It was done not even in my church. It was done in a restaurant in Massachusetts, 300 miles away from my church. Yet I was found guilty, and I was defrocked. I lost my career, my security, my paycheck, but I did appeal. And I won my appeal about 6 months later, and I was reinstated as a minister. The appeal was appealed by the Council for the Church, and I won that too, and which came as a real surprise to me, really indicating that the Church seems to be changing on the issue.
Do you remember the first inkling of feelings that you had that you might not be on the same page with the United Methodist Church in your beliefs as a minister? Did that take a while for you to realize what was going on, or was it a more sudden process in which when this issue came up, that was what caused all of this?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I knew that my church denomination was opposed to gay marriage when my son came out, and when my son asked me to perform his marriage, of course, I struggled with that issue, and I seriously prayed over this and talked with my wife and others about this, and I came to the conclusion that the love for my son was much more important than the love for my career. And I actually informed my superiors, even though I never told my congregation about it, because it was a very conservative congregation in a very conservative area. Mm-hmm. But I did let my superiors know in writing that I was going to perform this wedding and that I believed that this was a justice issue and that I was on the side of gay marriage and was standing with my children. I have three gay children. So I informed them, and I actually expected to be fired back then. I didn't even think of a trial. Mm. I thought I would get a phone call, you know, any time after I send off that letter, and they would just tell me, you're done. And I was willing to do that. I was willing to end my career back then in 2006 because it was much more important for me to stand with my children and stand for justice.
You mentioned that someone in your parish filed a charge against you. Did the larger church not do anything until that happened, or were other things already in process?
Yeah, it was very interesting for me to find out that, you know, there is this whole system, that this is really a systemic problem. My superiors, it turned out, especially my district superintendent, was fine with what I did, and he told me in person. In fact, he told me that he hid my file so that nobody could find my statement that I made to them in writing. And, you know, of course, he didn't publicly admit to that. Even in my trial, he didn't. But he told me in person that he was on the same side of the issue. And so it never got anywhere because of that. But once a complaint was filed by one of my parishioners, then the church is obliged to abide by the process that's outlined in our book of discipline, our law book, our doctrinal book. And so then they felt obliged to follow that.
I remember reading in your book that at one point, representatives of the church ask you to say you'd never do anything like that again. What kind of demands came to you from the church?
The process of negotiation, which we call the just resolution process, required of me that I would sign a document promising never to perform another same-sex marriage as long as that was illegal, according to our book of discipline. It also had other demands in it. There were five altogether, and one of them was that I was supposed to write a letter of apology to my congregation, taking the blame for pretty much everything that ever went wrong in that congregation. It was all listed up. It was amazing. So there were these five stipulations, and I really had most trouble, of course, with the statement that I would never perform a same-sex marriage again, especially in light of the fact that I do have three gay children. Three out of my four children are gay. And so there was a good chance, you know, my other children would ask me as well.
My goodness. I heard you say that early on you thought you were going to get fired. That didn't happen. Then the conflict arises. Was there a moment or were there many moments when you were just ready to walk away from all of it?
Actually, there were moments like that when I was going through a very difficult situation in my local church in Lebanon after all of this came out and, you know, came to the light. And it really was a very divisive time, and my congregation split, and it was very painful and so hard to go through that. And then in the negotiations ahead of the trial, you know, there were so many frustrating moments for me and my legal counsel. It appeared at the time that I wasn't even allowed to defend myself by pointing to other parts within the Book of Discipline that are affirming of gay people, that say, you know, we're all of sacred worth, and ministers are supposed to minister to everybody equally and not discriminate against anybody. But I wasn't allowed to do that. Uh-huh. So there were several moments when I felt like, you know, if they're going to defrock me, I'm not even going to go to church ever again. I'm not going to set foot into another church. I was just really, really disillusioned with the organization of the church.
And Frank, what got you through those moments? Why did you stick with it?
I started to receive letters and emails and Facebook messages from people within the church, from within the United Methodist Church, that stood solidly behind me and were encouraging me. Now, the LGBT community in the church, within the church, is quite large, and there, of course, are supporters and allies, and they reached out to me, and I found out that there's so much support.
Yeah.
I felt so isolated for many years. I thought, you know, I'm just one of few voices, but then I found out there's a whole movement within our church, and they all rallied behind me and my family, and we took so much courage and encouragement from that to know that there's another part of the church, and actually, I believe this part of the church is in the majority here mm-hmm. in the United States, and it just was an eye-opener to me, and it really restored my faith in the church.
Yeah, yeah. The 7 years that this has taken to finally be resolved has paralleled great changes in a number of denominations and their approach to same-gender marriage. And I wonder, what was it like to watch those somewhat dramatic changes taking place in other communions, and you were still dealing with threats to your ministry from inside your communion?
Yeah, it was a very bizarre experience because on the one hand, we saw a tremendous momentum shift in society. You know, we saw like state after state of allowing gay marriage to go forth. And we were really celebrating that. And we were thinking, oh, my goodness, you know, even the polls are changing. And now the majority of the population, of the U.S. population, supports gay marriage. And here I am struggling. Within my church, I mean, an organization that should be on the forefront
yeah.
of a civil rights movement
yeah.
Like the LGBTQ movement, and not behind the times. You know, it was so sad to us to see that the church once again was behind the curveball and not ahead of it. It really should be ahead of it because, I mean, the message that we have to the world is that God loves all of us. God
right.
loves all of God's children, and why aren't we doing this?
Reverend Schaefer, there continues to be a far-right impulse to condemn same-gender relationships and basically to disown faith leaders who diverge from that hardline position. I'm curious, you hear from a lot of people. What do you say to our fellow pastors and others who are faithfully struggling with this issue but basically feeling bullied to toe the line?
Well, I really try to make clear to them that what we're doing as a church by either, you know, proclaiming loudly from the Christian right that homosexuality is a sin, or by being complicit to the message, by not saying anything against it, is that people get hurt. And I think what really speaks to people in my conversations that I find out is when I do share the story of my son, Tim, that he really was harmed by the doctrine of the church. He
yeah.
he was such a faithful young man. He was so faithful to the church. He got involved in its ministries very early. You know, he was a good pastor's kid, and his faith was very important to him. So for him to find out that his own church was saying that, you know, there is a chance that as a homosexual you will go to hell, you won't make it into heaven, it was devastating for him.
Yeah.
I mean, it was devastating. He was 13, 14 years old when he first heard that message at the church conference, and he really agonized over this.
Sure.
He believed for a while that he was going to hell, and he was
yeah.
praying every night, he said, crying himself to sleep. He was praying to God, please take this away from me.
Yeah.
I don't want to be homosexual. I don't want to be a bad person. I want to go to heaven. I take this away from me. And it was, he was in agony to a point where the pain was so big, he just thought the best thing was just to kill himself,
yeah.
you know, to get rid of the pain. And people have to understand that the statements that seem like harmless statements on paper do these kinds of things to people, to real people, and it is causing them harm. And the thing is, I don't think anybody, not even people from the furthest Christian right, want to do harm to people. I believe they don't realize what this is doing
mm-hmm.
to our children and to our members in the church, and of course to just the LGBTQ community in general. They don't know, and I think once they find out by stories like my son, they start to think about this in a different light.
Yeah. I am concerned about what you say to our colleagues and so forth, but I'm much more interested in what you say to LGBT people struggling with this. A few years ago, I was out in Salt Lake City and spoke to a group of Mormons who literally until that moment, I think, had never heard a minister express compassion for them as GLBT Mormons and to say to them that God is not condemning you. It was one of the most moving experiences of my life, and I have to ask you, what do you say when someone like your son writes you or calls you and says, my church is telling me I can't be who I am, I'm going to hell if I stay true to my identity, what should I do? What do you say?
Yeah, and of course, I'm having these conversations all the time.
I'm sure.
Since I've been speaking in 26 states just in this year alone.
Yeah.
At churches, at seminaries, and universities. The first thing I do is I tell them, I am so sorry.
Yes.
For what the church has done to you. You know, that should have never, ever happened.
Right.
That should have never happened. That's not the true message of the church. And then I affirm them, just like I did my son, saying, you know, you were created in the image of God just like everybody else. Gay and all, God loves you. God is proud of you for who you are, a gay person or a transgender person or a bisexual person. God is proud of you. You know, God is with you in your struggle. Don't give up. And don't give up on the church because we're coming around. You know, there are many denominations now that are either already affirming, open and affirming, and reconciling, or that are coming around to that point. And even churches like the United Methodist Church has a large movement within it, the reconciling movement, that is mm-hmm. reaching out to our LGBTQ brothers and sisters. So yeah. Hang in there. Don't give up on your faith. You know, yeah. We're coming around.
Frank, what has this done to you? I mean, what has it done to you as a person of faith and as a faith leader?
It has really transformed me tremendously. It was definitely an evolution for me because I was raised in a Baptist church where I was taught that homosexuality is a sin. And so at one point, as a young man, that's what I believed because that's what I was taught. And it was, you know, not only the coming out of my children that changed me, but it was even in the period before that I got to know people, that I got to know LGBTQ folks that shared their story with me, and I started to look at it in a different light. And so I was slowly transformed from an opponent, really, to a tolerant person, to a secret supporter, then finally to an outspoken advocate. But it was a transition for me, and that it was difficult, you know, because
sure.
The teaching of the church is so powerful, and what is at stake, of course, is the wellness of your soul, is your future in heaven or hell. You know, that's a very powerful, powerful entity.
Yeah.
So the church's responsibility is huge, because in a sense, what we're doing right now with this doctrine is we're abusing folks
right.
spiritually.
Exactly.
When we make them believe they're going to hell for something that they're created to be by our wonderful Creator.
Right. I know it had to be difficult to retrace all of these steps and write the book that you've written. When someone reads that book, finishes it, puts it down, what do you hope they got from it?
Well, for one thing, that you should always stand up for what is right, for what you believe to be right in your heart and just. You should always follow your conscience and stand firm, even if it is in front of your biggest bully. And the second thing is that as you do, I believe that God will not let you down. That's my experience. I mean, the last year and a half was very difficult for me and my family, but, you know, there were so many blessings on the way. And look, I'm still United Methodist minister, curiously enough, and I'm able to change the church from within. And I have never backed down. And so God has provided throughout all of this struggle, financially, you know, emotionally, spiritually, in all kinds of ways. So if you do what is right, you know, good karma will get back to you. You know, God will not let you down.
Was it all right if you used karma from the United Methodist perspective?
You know, I think so, because I think it's a very good concept. And look, other religions have so much to teach about God as well, and we shouldn't be close to that.
Oh, I'm in full agreement. The Reverend Frank Schaefer endured prosecution within his denomination, the United Methodist Church, after officiating at the same-gender wedding of his son Tim 7 years ago. In October, he was finally reinstated after losing his ministry in a church court. He tells his story in a marvelous book, Defrocked, How a Father's Act of Love Shook the United Methodist Church. Frank, you should know that here on State of Belief, we have followed what you were doing almost every step of the way. We've talked about it on air. We've given the kind of support that we could give through a media outlet. And it's just a thrill to sit and talk with you today and hear what good shape you're in and what good faith you're in. And so I just have to thank you for being who you are, for what you've done. You have our utmost respect and support. Thank you for being with us today on this Thanksgiving weekend. You're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Walter.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. What a good show. What interesting people. What great thoughts. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. A big thank you to listeners who have made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com, that's stateofbelief.com, and keep us in mind on December 2nd, Giving Tuesday. You know, we make this show very easy to share. Sign up for our podcast at stateofbelief.com. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. And share the stories you find compelling with your friends. The same goes with Twitter. We're at twitter.com/stateofbelief. It's a great way for you to be an active part of getting these important voices to reach more people at a time when the noise in social media threatens to drown them out. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what?